Good morning, members. Good morning, ladies and gentlemen. If the committee will now come to order. We do have a quorum, so our first task here can be to approve the minutes of our February 9th meeting. Is there a member who would like to... Thank you, Representative Nelson. He's moved approval of the February 9th minutes. Any discussion? All those in favor... Representative House.
They're absolutely wonderful, outstanding minutes, but when they pack them in our folders, would you have them be marked up?
We can see about that.
If I finish this, would I have 2 votes?
No.
No.
Okay. Half a vote. We do that in Democratic conventions. I don't know what you do on your side, but
in ours, we give some people 1.5.
We do some of that, too.
Yeah.
All those in favor of the motion to approve the February 9th minutes, please indicate by saying aye.
Aye.
Opposed? Motion prevails. Thank you, members. Our first bill up this morning is House File 611. Representative Anzels, I've seen you here somewhere. There you are, sir. If you would please come forward. I will move House File 611 to be before the committee, recommended to pass, and sent to the Committee on Commerce and Labor. Representative Anzels, welcome to the committee.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman and members. It's good to be here on a Friday morning, especially in front of this committee. House File 611 is about workers, workplace communication, workplace interaction. It's about speech. It involves both the public and the private sector. It excludes independent contractors. And it is about communication that is electronic, printed, advertisements, of course, emails, text messages, electronic, oral, in the workplace, in the lunchroom, on the job site, in the hallway, on the telephone. Basically, this is about workers having the right to communicate with workers. This legislation would prohibit an employer, again, in both the public and the private sector, from disciplining or discharging a worker because a worker has chosen to interact with his or her employee organization or labor organization. The employer is barred from interfering in communication between workers and is barred from intimidating or coercing workers from any form of communication. A couple of examples. Within the building trades on job sites, the laborer representative or steward on the job oftentimes would have a brochure or a notice to members of his or her union notifying the workers at the job site during coffee break of a get-together at Joe's Bowling Alley to celebrate the retirement of a co-worker. We think that communication should be allowed without intimidation, without coercion, without any form of control by the employer. Another example. We think that email communication between workers in a public sector setting announcing that Tuesday, February 28th is going to be Public Employee Day at the courthouse. And there's going to be a celebration involving workers' rights, commemorating all that workers have done in contributing to a particular colony. We think those kinds of communications should be allowed without coercion, without intimidation, without any threat or fear of discipline. The bill includes a remedy to workers. If this is a collective, if a collective bargaining agreement is in place, again, this is either public or private sectors. The terms and conditions of the collective bargaining agreement that are in place will be followed. If in the instance that there is not a collective bargaining agreement, then civil action for damages would be allowed. Damages would be limited to the greater of lost wages and benefits, the costs to the organization in producing the communication, or $1,000 plus court costs and reasonable fees. Again, this is about free speech. It should not be construed to be anything beyond basic civil rights, basic free speech rights in the workplace. And it is designed to level the playing field somewhat for Minnesota's workers. With me today, and they're here to answer any concerns that you may have, are Teresa Joppa, staff attorney for Council 65, the American Federation of State, County, and Municipal Employees. And I also have a worker, a real Minnesota worker who happens to be a librarian from Carver County, Ms. Susan Hunt. And also a representative of the AFL-CIO is here if need be. So, Mr. Chair and members, I'd be happy to try to answer any questions that you might have.
May I recommend, Representative Anzels, why don't we have your testifiers come forward and testify and then move to questions.
Teresa Joppa, Staff Attorney, Council 65 from AFSCME. Thank you.
Ms. Joppa, welcome to the committee. Please introduce yourself for the record and proceed.
Thank you. Thanks for your time, committee members and chairman. My name is Teresa Joppa, last name spelled J-O-P-P-A. I'm a staff attorney for AFSCME Council 65. I've worked for AFSCME for 6 years. Part of that where I worked for a different labor union here in Minnesota for 11 years. I'm from the city of Moorhead. I thank you for granting me a few moments today to talk about House Bill 611, which involves communications amongst unionized workers in the workplace. This legislation is basically intended to get both employers and employees on the same page about and using the same rules about emails and other kinds of workplace communication. For many years, everybody's been on the same page with regards to a bulletin board in the workplace. You could always post a notice about the union picnic or the union meeting or whatever on an employee bulletin board in the workplace. But that's not today's reality. Today's reality is that we're all exchanging emails daily, sometimes checking our emails several times a day. But then again, there also are those employees who don't have any email in the workplace. They need to exchange communications amongst each other, whether it's in the break room or as they're out on the road job doing repairs to the highway, what have you. Many employers have been quite generous and accommodating for these kinds of communications, and there haven't been issues in the workplace. But then on the other hand, we have run into a number of employers who have really been quite hostile to employees exchanging, whether it is an email during their break time or a lunch time, or discussing these topics in the lunchroom. Some have prohibited the most innocuous of communications. Sometimes we need to hurry and schedule a grievance meeting with the HR person quite quickly, and the best way to do that sometimes is by exchanging an email through that employer's communication system or computer system. Many of our employees have home computers, and we can exchange emails with them that way, but many people only get their emails at work. And so we want to be able to send out those meeting notices, or the notice that the meeting got canceled, or the information about the Labor Day picnic, what have you, in the workplace. I've even worked with some employees who have been disciplined for attempting to settle a grievance with an employee and a coworker. I have a union president right now who's going through the disciplinary process for having settled a termination grievance in favor of the employer. They worked out in a resignation and a severance package for a longtime employee. But right after they got done signing off on all the paperwork, my union steward was disciplined for having used the city's email to accomplish the end goal that really was in favor of both the employer and the employee. So we're quite concerned that more employers will take that tack. At the same time, there's lots of emails and communications and flyers and paperwork that go through everybody's workplace concerning the United Way or walkathons or Relay for Life, news about somebody's new baby or their retirement, that pass through the communication systems on all levels in the workplace, and we would like to have our kinds of communications treated in the same manner. This legislation includes some language which says that the employer can establish reasonable rules regarding the review of union communications during break time or other non-work time, and you'll find that language at the bottom of the first page at lines 1.24 and 1.25. We're certainly comfortable with reasonable time, place, and manner restrictions. Personal emails, including emails about union business, or brochures in your mailbox if you're a teacher or a police officer or a social worker, should be read on off-duty time or your break time or after work. You can pick it up and take it home with you, what have you. We're fine with those kinds of reasonable rules being set out by the employer or negotiated through a collective bargaining agreement type situation. That we are comfortable with. So I guess if there are some questions, I'd be happy to answer those.
Members, any questions for Ms. Joppa at this time? Representative Gunther.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Ms. Joppa.
Yes.
How many employers do this? I look at times that we're going through in Minnesota right now as being definitely one of not having abundance of labor available to work in any one job or any one occupation. We are going to be in a terrific shortage in 2 years, they claim. So when you look at this, how many employers do now prohibit communication? I find it incredible.
Well, actually, as I said...
Ms. Joppa.
Yes, thank you, Mr. Chairman. As I said a little earlier, most employers have not established rules about this, but a few have started to place restrictions on it that are really difficult to work out. And I would like all employers and all employees to be operating under the same rules as opposed to each employer and each employee organization having to find their way and reinvent the wheel. So I guess I'm hoping this legislation will just get everybody on the same page so that there aren't a lot of complicated restrictions in one place and no restrictions in another place.
Representative Gunther.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Would you say you've had complaints from 5 employers, 10, 5%?
I'd
employees
say that...
complaining that...
Ms. Joppa, excuse me. Promoted you.
I'd say that in the past year, I've probably dealt with 5 employers, but I'm not the only staff person in our office that is dealing with this issue. And you multiply that by all the different workplaces and all the different unions in the state, in both private and public settings. We're talking about a lot of different places and a lot of different issues.
Representative Ansels, are you wanting to respond to this question?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And just to add to the response to Representative Gunther's very pertinent question. I've experienced situations where employers are actually helpful and cooperative and want workers to communicate. And then I've seen just the opposite, where there's intimidation, where there is very clearly communicated that workers are not allowed to distribute information, are not allowed to do anything, quite frankly, other than their job. And I'm referring to situations within the building trades. And one thing that I've learned in my experience throughout the building trades is what situations are best when labor and management are in sync, where labor-management cooperation is the rule, where that's where productivity is high, and we just think that this legislation levels the playing field somewhat and adds some uniformity in Minnesota workplaces, both public and private sector.
Representative Gunther, continue.
Thank you. That was a great statement. I appreciate it very much, and I know for a fact that one of the best things about unions are is one union member will take the actions, the inappropriate actions of another union member who's sloughing off or whatever, and he'll find a way to get rid of that member. And that's what I've always appreciated about unions.
Representative Chairman, I don't know much about sloughing off, but quite frankly, this would apply in non-collective bargaining situations equally.
Representative Gunther.
I've had up to 155 employees, and those 15, 16-year-old high school kids that I hired in the grocery store, it took them 3 months to know where every hiding place there was.
Representative House.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Representative Anzalk. I'm 97% on board. So let's see if we can fix the 3%. I have a question, and as long as we have the attorney next to you, she may be able to help you with this. On page 1, line 24, where it says, on their work computer, and in the definition of the word there, does that mean the employer's computer, and does that open the door for any communication on the employer's computer that the employee is using?
Well,
Ms. Joppa.
Thanks, Mr. Chairman. I take it to mean whatever computer they have before them and that they make use of in the workplace. Most of those computers will be a computer purchased by the employer. There aren't very many employees who have their own laptop or computer that they bring back and forth, but there will be some.
Representative House.
Mr. Chairman, then I'm assuming, pardon me for assuming, but I'm assuming that they are probably gathering or reading emails either on their work email, or maybe they've installed have been allowed to install their access to their home email and they can access that. I don't have a problem with that at all. But would this bill then allow them to organize a labor convention in Chicago during work hours on the laptop or on the computer?
Ms. Joppa?
I don't believe so, because if the employer used the next sentence that they set up reasonable rules concerning the reviews of these types of communications during non-working time, that rule would have to be followed. And so the organizing of a Labor Day rally or a convention travel, as you give us an example, that has to be done on non-working time or during break time. And so that, I think, I hope, cures that kind of a problem.
Representative House.
Mr. Chairman, we're 98% there. On the second page, starting on line 6 and finishing on line 7, where it says, prevailing employee or employee organization and the action court costs and reasonable attorney fees. Okay, so the court could award the cost to an employee if they filed a complaint. Well, I've always been one to be fair and balanced, and please forgive me, Mr. Chairman, for quoting the former speaker. But being fair and balanced, you want to also, if an employee brings a claim against the employer and the employer wants to defend themselves or just acquiesce, I think it's only fair that the employer, if proven correct, would have the opportunity to collect costs.
Ms. Joppa?
representative, I would think that most of these disputes would get resolved in a collective bargaining situation and go to arbitration. In arbitration, both sides pay half. The union pays half, management pays half, regardless of the outcome. And I would see that most of the disputes concerning this situation, if somebody was disciplined for having exchanged some sort of communication or passed a pamphlet or something like that, would go there first. Ultimately, it could go to court. I would think that if the max that you can get out of it all is $1,000 plus some attorney's fees, that hopefully we would also not be in court very often about this.
Representative House.
Mr. Chairman, I suppose I'm 99% of the way there, and I'll wait with the 1% for the rest of the testifiers.
Could you clarify for the committee what percentage you need to be at? Thank you, Representative House. Ms. Hunt would come forward, please. Librarians being amongst the best people in the world.
Was she in that movie? The Librarian?
You're outside of my cultural references, Representative Howe, sorry. Ms. Hunt, welcome to the committee. Please introduce yourself for the tape and proceed.
Thank you. Good morning. My name is Suzanne Hunt, S-U-Z-A-N-N-E-H-U-N-T. I live in Chaska, Minnesota, and I've been employed for the last 6 years as a librarian for the county of Carver, which is one of the fastest growing and one of the wealthiest counties in the state of Minnesota. I'm also the president of AFSCME Local 2789. Of the 600 or so employees of Carver County, roughly 380 to 400 at any given time are covered by a bargaining contract under the auspices of AFSCME. I have a large group of people. I'm also a steward for AFSCME Local 2789, and I'm also a member of the Council 65 Executive Board. Thank you for allowing me to speak today. My role here is as a real-life employee and a worker. I've lived in Minnesota all my life, and I believe that this is a truly great state, and owing not a little to the strong presence of unions and the hard work that unions have done in this state. We all do better when we all do better. We know that saying. I currently am fortunate to work for an employer who does allow communication among union members, primarily to promote and announce meetings among our membership. You can imagine in Carver County, we have members who are out on road crews and in court with social services and child protection issues. We have 5 branch libraries that are spread out over a geographically large county that is still largely rural. Communication, to put it mildly, can be problematic for the employer and the union. And I would say that 90% of the workers of Carver County do have access to county computers that they would call their own that sit on their desks. And that is how they receive probably 99% of their communications, both from the employer and the union. We are allowed to announce general membership meetings, not only on our bulletin boards. There is a bulletin board in the main courthouse and a bulletin board in one of our social services buildings as well. But primarily and chiefly, the main means of communication is by use of email. When, as a steward, the Employee Relations Department, or as president, either capacity, when Employee Relations wants to reach me, they email me. I would hazard a guess that you probably keep in touch with each other and with your constituents largely through email. I think that this bill is very important because it basically codifies and puts in writing and makes consistent a practice that is in use primarily today by most employers who wish to communicate with their members and with their employees. I also have seen sort of the bad side of this too. Early in my career as a president, I was asked by a now former employee of the Employee Relations Department to contact her regarding an issue of a grievance. And the next morning I called her on my break time and later was disciplined for making a phone call at work using the company phone, even though it was at their request. So I know how sometimes the sign of a dysfunctional family or unit is that you don't know what the rules are until you break them. And I think that this is a good start for putting the rules in place so that everybody knows what they are. And with that, I would be happy to take any questions and maybe provide the extra 1%.
Thank you, Ms. Hunt. And here's your chance, Representative House.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. In reading lines 10 through 12 on the first page, definition of employer means any person, business entity, or nonprofit organization. Would that, Representative Anzelk, include MnDOT, DNR, Hennepin County, etc.? The list goes on.
Representative Anzelk.
Mr. Chair and Representative Hawes, yes, it would.
Mr. Chairman.
Representative Hawes.
Representative Anzelk, would that include us?
Representative Anzels.
Mr. Chairman and Representative Hawes hadn't thought of it, but...
We should.
It should.
Representative Hawes.
Please, Mr. Chairman, you just got advice from staff.
Ms. Newman, would you like to respond to this?
Mr. Chair and Representative Hawes, on line 11, the language goes on and says it includes the state and any subdivisions.
Thank you. I should learn to read it further.
Your choice, Representative House.
Mr. Chairman, I am 99% there, and I'd like to get 100% there. Representative Anzelk has been in the building trades industry his whole life, as I have been, and it probably doesn't affect you and I as much as it does other workers throughout the state in different work environments and unique situations. But being either as a union representative, as you formerly were, and... being as we're representatives now, sometimes we have to look to the future and we have to somehow sometimes predict or protect from future actions that could transpire, be they local, state, or federal. So, Mr. Chairman, I do have an amendment that would put me at 100% if we could get this amendment on. And I believe your staff has 50 copies.
Yes. If the pages could distribute the amendment, Representative House, is this the A1 amendment?
This would be... The A1 amendment, correct.
All right. Why don't you go ahead and describe the amendment while pages are distributing it to the members?
Okay. Mr. Chairman, the amendment is coming. Mr. Chairman, Representative Anzelk, page 1, line 25, after the period, we insert, "An employer may not remove or ban a non-public smoking area designated on or before the date of enactment of this section."
Excuse me, but I don't have the amendment.
We'll get you one, Representative Anzel.
You'll get one, Representative Anzel. This committee is fair and balanced. We allow the authors to read the amendments.
Representative House,
I could explain my...
Well, if we can hold up just 1 second, give Representative Anzels a moment. On page 1, line 2 of your amendment, after the quotes, you have A-N-D. Should that be A-N?
Mr. Chairman, you're correct. I will remove the D in AND and incorporate that.
So moved.
Mr. Chairman, I could explain the purpose for the amendment. Obviously, we all know that there's a smoking ban moving forward through the House of Representatives, and if there are manufacturing facilities or, as one of the bills coming up later, meatpacking facilities, anywhere where employees work indoors, and there may or may not be, but let's say there is today, a non-public smoking area or smoking room that employees are allowed to use. I want to make sure that in this bill we make it very clear to employers that if the statewide smoking ban prevails for no smoking in public places, that we have now established that maybe some of these employers have non-public smoking areas, and I want to define that difference between no smoking in public or smoking in non-public. And I know with manufacturing plants, some of them during the wintertime it's very warm in there. Sometimes they deal with moisture, oil drippings, etc. Their pants, their socks could be a little damp, and if they don't keep that smoking room and then are forced to go outside in 10 above or 10 below weather, I'm really concerned about their health. They could catch pneumonia and then maybe miss 2 weeks of work. So, Mr. Chairman, I would move the A1 amendment for adoption, basically to protect what's already established in the workplace. If it's not established, it really doesn't matter. But if it's established, I think it's something we need to protect. And I know people say only 25% of people smoke, but that would be 25% of the workers that we would be sort of punishing or forcing to go outside in cold weather and catch cold or pneumonia. Mr. Chairman, I'm very concerned about their health.
I appreciate your concern for workers' health. The Representative Howes moves the A1 amendment. Discussion to the amendment. Representative Anzos?
Mr. Chairman and Representative Howes, I know how you have supported workers throughout your career here. And while supporting workers' right to consume tobacco is one thing, this bill is more about communication, verbal and electronic. And really, I would not support your amendment. I would just simply say it makes more complex a very simple piece of legislation that should be loved by all.
Is there anyone in the audience wishing to testify either for or against the House amendment?
Mr. Chairman,
Representative House,
in honor of the author and his explanation of his not liking the amendment, I will withdraw the amendment. It may surface again later today, but I will withdraw the amendment.
All right. Thank you. Representative House withdraws the A1 amendment. Representative Anzels, there are some others who wish to testify regarding the bill.
Mr. Chair.
I'm hearing voices. Representative Anderson.
Representative Howes had brought up an issue prior to his amendment that I just wanted to get some clarification, perhaps from Ms. Newman or Representative Anzels. And it was about the state employees being included in this. Does this include House employees that are considered essential?
Ms. Newman. Ms. Jaffa.
Mr. Chair and Ms. Anderson, I wrote this as simply and as straightforwardly as I could to uncover as many workplaces in Minnesota as I could. And so, in my view, it would cover those employees.
Thank you. We have on the list Dave Diedrichs, if I've got that right. I apologize if I do not, from the Chamber of Commerce, and Alec Beck, Seton Beck and Peters. Good morning. Welcome to the committee. Please introduce yourself for the tape.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members. My name is Dave Diedrichs, and you did pronounce my name correctly. Thank you, Mr. Chair. And I do represent the Minnesota Chamber of Commerce. The Minnesota Chamber of Commerce has over 2,400 member businesses. Over 80% of our member businesses have less than 100 employees. Our members represent all aspects of the economy throughout the state of Minnesota, and we have 130 local chamber affiliates throughout the state. Thanks for this opportunity today to talk about House File 611. And, Mr. Chair, on a personal note, I would just like to let you and the members of the committee know that I'm especially privileged to be here today because Representative Benson was my high school political science teacher.
Mr. Chairman, I take no responsibility for the testimony my former student may provide.
Representative Benson, that was the obvious next question. Mr. Duda.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And Representative Benson, I'd like to finish before you take responsibility. Anything I do or don't say. Thank you. Mr. Chair, members, the Minnesota Chamber of Commerce does oppose this bill because we believe it's preempted by federal law. Before I delve into the specific issues with the language in this bill, I'd like to predicate my remaining comments on two applicable rules of law that have been delineated by the United States Supreme Court that apply in labor law issues like this. The case is Garmin versus the San Diego unions. It's actually a case law from 1959, but it's still considered seminal law in this area. So this has been law that has been applied in situations like this for over 40 years. And the two applicable rules of law from that case are: when an activity is actually or arguably subject to either Section 7 or Section 8 of the National Labor Relations Act, states as well as federal courts must defer to the exclusive competence of the National Labor Relations Board. Second, the case goes on to say, moreover, the failure of the National Labor Relations Board to define legal significance under the Act of any particular activity does not give states power to act. So with those two principles in mind, I'd like to delve into some of the more specific issues of language within this bill. And I would also like to address, along with that, the concerns are actually some of the statements that were made by Ms. Joppa regarding one of the primary reasons behind this bill was for the use of email communications or other similar text messages or means to communicate with employees. You'll notice I have with me here, and I'll hold this up, I have a notice from the National Labor Relations Board that is actually posted on their website. And this is a notice for a hearing that's occurring next month, March 27th, 2007. And the reason this hearing is occurring is the National Labor Relations Board is discussing these issues. The issues presented in this case include whether employees have the right to use their employer's email system or other computer-based communication systems to communicate with other employees about union or other concerted protected matters. Mr. Chair and members, the issues being resolved in this bill are very similar. This is clearly an ambiguous area of federal law, and under the dictates of Garmin that I outlined it below, this is an area of law that is subject to the purview of the National Labor Relations Board as they apply the National Labor Relations Act. That means, in this instance, federal law should control, and therefore state law in this area is preempted, which is why the Chamber believes that this language in this bill would be preempted. Finally, employers do have concerns about union business being conducted during work hours if this email issue would go through. Second, on lines 1.19 through 1.21, the subdivision under prohibited practice, we believe that this is governed by Section 8A3 of the National Labor Relations Act, which defines unfair labor practices by employers against unions or union employees' Section 7 rights under the National Labor Relations Act. Specifically, it says employers may not discriminate in regards to the hiring or tenure of employment because of union activity, which would certainly cover the language that's covered in this prohibited practice section. So if this is a Section 8 activity protecting a Section 7 right, then again, deferring to Garmin, the United States Supreme Court says this is under the exclusive competence of the National Labor Relations Act and therefore the NLRB. Next, on lines 1.22 through 1.24, we believe this is also covered by federal law. The National Labor Relations Act, Section 8A1, states that it shall be an unfair labor practice for an employer to interfere with employees in the exercise of their Section 7 rights. This section is violated whenever an employer violates an employee's Section 7 rights, and that would be a right to organize, bargain collectively, or other concerted activities. So again, being a Section 8 right pertaining to Section 7, it would be under the purview of the National Labor Relations Board. And finally, in Subdivision 3, the remedies section, the language states that if there's a violation in the subdivision, the remedy is either through an applicable grievance procedure or through a civil action. And in the case of an actual union being certified to represent an employee, the governing collective bargaining agreement would be the only applicable means to resolve any disputes. Otherwise, the entire collective bargaining system would be undermined if an employee didn't like having those types of issues be resolved under collective bargaining grievance procedures. They could go to court. So that's why in this section, with the either or, we believe that if an employee is covered already with a collective bargaining agreement, that grievance procedure is already outlined and they can't have a civil action. Mr. Chair and members, the Chamber believes that the principles of federal law already governs the issues discussed in this bill, and therefore we believe it would be preempted by federal law.
Mr. Diedrichsen, a question occurred to me as I was listening to your testimony. You're focused on national labor relations law. Does national labor relations law govern the organizing of public employees in Minnesota?
Mr. Chair, members, I'm not sure. I would have to defer to counsel on that issue.
Ms. Newman?
Mr. Chair and members, public employees are not covered under the NLRA. Minnesota has the Public Employee Labor Relations Act to deal with.
Thank you, Ms. Newman. Questions for Mr. Diedrich? Representative Nelson.
Mr. Chairman, you already asked my question.
Some efficiencies. All right. Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Thank you.
On deck, I have Mr. Alec Beck and Mr. Dick Brainerd in the on-deck circle. Sir, welcome to the committee. Please introduce yourself to the tape.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. My name is Alec Beck. I am a labor lawyer. I do represent management. I'm looking around this room and I realize I'm a bit outnumbered in that respect, so I'm going to tread lightly. In light of the previous speaker's comments, I think I can throw up about half of my outline here. I'm going to echo what he said about the preemption issue. This bill deals with what's called solicitation or non-solicitation under federal law, and with respect to the previous speaker, he indicated it was an ambiguous issue. It's not. It's definitely not. There have been thousands of cases, both in the federal courts and the National Labor Relations Board, on this issue. And what they've come down is that employers do have the right to restrict, under very limited circumstances, certain types of solicitations. And if they do it, to echo the previous speaker, they have to do it everywhere. In other words, I can't say as an employer, you can't talk about the union, but you can talk about United Way or Girl Scout cookies, that sort of thing. So these are very onerous provisions, but they have been held repeatedly to be legal by the National Labor Relations Board. So if the state of Minnesota passes this law, it's going to be passing a law that makes Minnesota different from every other of the 49 states. And that is specifically what's not allowed by the Garmin Doctrine and the many, many dozens of cases that have come up since. Mr. Chairman, I've worked on cases in the past that have involved this legislature, not this legislature, but long previous legislatures, passing laws that were similarly contrary to the federal labor law scheme. And what happens is, and there was testimony in those previous cases too, also indicating that the actions were preempted. The legislature passed laws anyway, and what happens is that a union, an employer, and the Attorney General's office have to engage in very lengthy, contentious litigation that costs a lot of time and money. And ultimately, at least in one case that I've worked on, our Minnesota Supreme Court indicated that, in fact, attempts like this are preempted by the federal labor law. That was the Midwest Motor Express case and Teamsters Local 120 case from 1994. So, again, I will just echo this. Right now, there are numerous attempts to try to change the federal labor law pending in the United States Congress. And if there's going to be a change, it has to be a change through the NLRB or through the Congress. That's where this fight belongs, not the state legislature.
Thank you. Questions for Mr. Beck? Thank you, sir.
Thank you.
Mr. Brainerd. Ironically, from Matamira. Welcome, sir, to the committee. Please introduce yourself to the table.
Thank you. Mr. Chair and members, my name is Dick Brainerd, and I am here today representing the League of Minnesota Cities. I am a member of the Board of League of Minnesota Cities. I co-chair the Policy Committee on Human Resources and Data Practices. I'm also a member of the Matamira City Council. By way of work experience, I've served as a human resources director for the Metropolitan Council, Ramsey County, and I also served as deputy commissioner of the Minnesota Department of Employee Relations. Mr. Chair and members, you've already heard testimony this morning that unions and employees already have protected rights to communicate during non-work time, both in FLA and in many collective bargaining agreements. Citing PELRA for state employees, Chapter 179, National Labor Relations Act, and collective bargaining contracts. As such, we do not understand the need for this legislation. heard the author of the bill talk about some of the miscellaneous things associated with employees in the workplace. By and large, I would like to go through 4 points which I believe will explain why the league does not support this bill. First, management needs to be able to regulate workplace communications during work time so that union communications do not interfere with city work. In other words, employees don't spend excessive time on union business and ignore their jobs. Second, management needs the right to regulate communications coming into the cities. We've heard discussion about electronic communications this morning. We're concerned especially about electronic communications such as email. Many public employers have strict policies about the use of their computers for inappropriate reasons, pornography, politics, personal use. Employers need to be able to review any employee communications to determine if employees are following city policies. Using city computers for union business potentially makes these communications public information. Therefore, the city should have the right to protect itself against data practices violations and lawsuits by regulating employees' use of computers. Third, the bill establishes stiff penalties for violation by employers, including an award of court costs and attorney fees to the union in addition to at least a $1,000 fine through civil action for damages. This is going to have, if passed, a chilling effect on the city's willingness to discipline for employee abuses of city equipment and city time. Fourth, employees and unions already have avenues to protect their rights to communicate. You've heard about the grievance and arbitration process that exists. Unfair labor practice actions can bring an unfair labor practice charge. Negotiation processes. Negotiate protections into the union contract. PELRA provides for that. There's an opportunity for employers and employee rights in the PELRA legislation to provide for communications. At a minimum, the league would ask the committee to consider amendments to this bill. We believe there will be an amendment offered that would eliminate the stiff penalties imposed on employers and clarify that employees still have the right to set, employers still have the right to set their own policies regulating quantity and content of employee communications and use of employee time for such communications and to monitor employees' time use and use of equipment. Lastly, I would like to give you an example of how this bill, if passed, could impact the city. For example, a labor organization is requesting that an email be sent to a city employee with a request to send it on to other city employees. At the last minute, a union employee decides to attach a joke to that email. The email is sent, opened by the employee in the city, and as requested by the union, the employee routes that email and the joke to others in the city. Others find that joke to be offensive. Some might even consider it to be creating a hostile work environment. The city would like to take action, but under this bill, as it's constituted presently, the city may not take disciplinary action against the employee who received the email, and the city could be faced with penalties set forth in the bill, which could go as high as $1,000. As well as court costs and attorney's fees. This leaves the city with a choice, of being sued by the union for taking action against the employee or for being sued by the employees in the work who work for the city because you've created a hostile work environment. Because of this, the league believes the city need to continue to have the ability to regulate the workplace communications coming into the city. Mr. Chair, members, that concludes my testimony.
Thank you, Mr. Brainerd. Any questions for the testifier? Representative House.
Yeah, Mr. Chairman, is there a law now that's upheld that tells employees they can't send a joke to another employee?
Mr. Brainerd.
Mr. Chair, Representative, as far as the law is concerned, I'm not sure about a law, but there are policies that possibly could prohibit, depending on how those policies are written within the workplace. Or by a city or by an employer.
Representative House.
My comment was I just thought it was a poor argument.
Any other questions?
Mr. Chair.
Representative Anderson.
Mr. Brainerd is coming today, Representative Anzo.
you have brought up an issue that has been a concern of mine in looking over this and having had managed employees. My concern is that it doesn't have to be a joke. If an employee views it as any kind of harassment at all, whether the content of the language is innocuous, if they feel that they're getting too many of those emails or whatever they deem as it being harassing behavior to them, they have the right to go to their employer, and then the employer is responsible for, one, first stopping the behavior, and two, following up and taking appropriate actions to address that concern. So it's not a poor argument at all. It's a serious problem that we have, and it opens up not only the cities, it opens up the state, and it opens up all of these businesses to huge liability to harassment. And that's my biggest concern when I'm looking at this, Representative Anzalk, is that we could, I know it's unintended consequences, but we could be in a world of hurt when it comes to this. And I think we'd have a lot of litigation going on. So just be forewarned of what it could end up happening.
Representative Anzalk.
Well, Mr. Chair and members and Representative, area that has not been explored yet in this excellent discussion is management's responsibility to supervise workers, whether those workers are in a collective bargaining situation or whether this is not a collective bargaining situation. And I think it is right to conclude that sound supervision, sound management, management that is effective, management that works with workers, management that communicates with workers, clearly can solve some of these extreme scenarios that have been suggested. So it would be my hope that, you know, communication is a two-way street. It works between workers, and it works and is necessary between management and workers as well. And this language is meant to even the playing field and bring some balance to that communication. But certainly, sound supervision and management of workers is a part of this topic.
Representative Anderson.
Mr. Chair, Representative Anzalk, you know, I clearly understand what your intent is. I'm just concerned about what the unintended consequences are. And that gets to the issue, as you mentioned, of discipline of your employees. As I read this bill, if an employee is spending their work time reviewing union communications or whatever, they would not have the right to discipline that employee. So that's the way I review this. Perhaps you can provide some clarity, but that's how the language to me is interpreted. And combined with the harassment issue, I'm really concerned about the unintended consequences of this legislation.
Representative Anzo.
Mr. Chair, thank you again. Could I bring the attorney back to respond?
Certainly. Ms. Trappa.
The issue is disciplining the unusual circumstance,
Ms. Chapman,
where this happens.
I did hear the suggestion made, you know, the hypothetical about what if a joke got attached and sent him. And I think that I'm in agreement with the representative that the employer has the right to regulate that. And I have seen many, many more employers put out a policy about harassing behavior in the workplace being unacceptable. Respectful workplace kinds of policies would certainly cover that type of communication. It's not our intent here to override any of those kinds of reasonable rules. In fact, we encourage those kinds of reasonable rules. And so I would think that's what's meant in the sentence, the last sentences on the first page, is that reasonable rules concerning when you access this and what type of appropriate communications versus inappropriate communications is really what this is about. This legislation concerns communications from one employee to another that concern union business or workplace issues. And it's not meant to cover those types of notices, whether they're offensive or inoffensive. And the inoffensive ones, as I gave before as examples, were the United Way or some sort of fundraiser or somebody's retirement occasion or what have you. This is really about when's the union meeting. We have to hurry and have a grievance meeting with HR because there's some timelines in the union contract for getting that done. It's really about conducting the everyday business of the employee organization and letting our members and other employees know what's going on with regard to that.
Representative Anderson.
Ms. Java, I appreciate that. The only concern that I have, a couple of things. First, when I looked at the language of reasonable, what's reasonable to one person may not be reasonable to another. And so that language alone is just, for me, too vague, especially in the litigation-happy world that we live in. And no offense to people that make their living, that's their deal. But I just think that we would need clarity on that. As the other issue that you had, having managed people, the message that was sent, the content of it wouldn't matter. But say an individual received 10 of these emails, and frankly, they just didn't like it. They felt it was pressuring or it was harassing to them. As an employer, it is their responsibility to make sure that they have that behavior stopped. And then it gets down to, okay, well, then is that considered reasonable? And then you can see how it can all snowball, and pretty soon you'll find that you've got these folks in court, and, you know, it's not helping us get at what I think the concern that Representative Ansel has here. So unintended consequences, huge here.
Representative Anderson, is that a question or?
More of a comment. I apologize.
No apology needed. Representative Benson.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I would like to get a response from Ms. Chapa and also from Representative Ansel about Mr. Diedrich's discussion of federal law and court decisions, and particularly his note that an issue similar to this will be before the National Labor Relations Board within a short period of time, and whether how that would affect your proceeding with this bill at this time.
Ms. Joppa?
Thank you. I would like to address that comment about the NLRB and preemption to the committee. This bill covers so many more employees than just those covered by the National Labor Relations Act. The National Labor Relations Act is, as indeed has been portrayed, a federal law that concerns workplace behaviors between management and unions for those employees that are covered by that particular statute. There are so many more employees in the state of Minnesota that are not covered by the National Labor Relations Act. There's numbers restrictions under the National Labor Relations Act. You also have to have interstate commerce in order for the National Labor Relations Act to even apply. I think that there are some workplace regulations that you already have in place in Chapter 181, where this statute is designed to go, that already cover those employees as well as all the other employees that we're intending to cover here. You have your state employees, you have your local city, county, school district, and nursing home types of employees who are not covered by the National Labor Relations Act if they don't work for a private employer. You have your Charitable Hospitals Act, which covers those types of entities in the state not covered by the National Labor Relations Act. I think we could easily say that the language in the statute could be distinguished as covering those types of employees if there is the preemption issue. And indeed, as has been pointed out, there are similar issues being taken up in many states around the country and also in front of the National Labor Relations Board. There are cases proceeding concerning workplace forms of communication, including emails and computers. And I think that was one of the things that also prompted the discussion in my workplace about what can we do to address these issues in a way that gets, as I said at the beginning of my testimony, employers and employees all on the same page about how do we communicate When do we communicate, and in what form will we communicate? So that's the intent of this legislation, is to help get everybody on the same page in each and every single workplace.
Representative Anzos, you wanted to respond as well?
Very briefly, Mr. Chairman and Representative Benson. Earlier in our discussion, I used the word balance. And I want the committee to focus on that word balance as it relates to the National Labor Relations Board. And I would submit to you, the National Labor Relations Board is out of balance. It's actually, it'd be more accurate to call this the National Employer Relations Board. Because of this imbalance, states such as Minnesota and others around the country are offering legislation like this to correct imbalances, to bring common sense, balance, and fairness back to the workplace, because the NLRB is not doing it.
Representative Benson.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I have watched also the history of the NLRB over the last number of years and have seen what happens when an administration which is in some ways hostile to organized labor is able to place its representatives on an important board such as that. But the reality is, except for the groups that you discussed, Ms. Joppa, the NLRB does have jurisdiction in many of these areas. And so here's the question. Is the fact that this bill covers groups that the National Labor Relations Board would also have jurisdiction over complicate our bill here in the sense that we are anxious to provide protections for groups that are not under the jurisdiction of the National Labor Relations Board?
Ms. Joppa?
Well, I would hope not. And I think that Minnesota has a lot of different laws that apply in workplaces that are covered by the NLRB, that those laws have not been considered as preempted by the NLRB and its various decisions made by the board as it changes its political stripes with each administration that comes and goes. You have laws about drug and alcohol testing in the workplace. You have laws about genetic testing. You have the Government Data Practices Act. You have lots of different kinds of laws that affect the workplace that are passed by the Minnesota State Legislature that affect private and public employers in the state of Minnesota without having those concerns. I like to think of it a little bit like the Fair Labor Standards Act. Employers in Minnesota or any place else can always do more than what the minimum is. And so I get a lot of management coming to me and say, well, we can't give this kind of employee who's exempt more money than what the Fair Labor Standards Act says. We don't have to pay them overtime. You're right, you don't have to pay them overtime. But you can pay them more. It sets a minimum, not a ceiling. And I like to think of the NLRB laws kind of like that. They set a minimum standard for behavior between employers and employees and unions and management, and not a ceiling. And so I guess I am hopeful that that you can still see the benefit of passing this legislation.
Representative Dietrich, was your question to this point?
No.
All right, thank you. If you can hold then, please. Representative Nelson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I guess my question was for Mr. Brainerd when he was talking about, and if I'll direct it to him. Currently, when you're communicating with your employees at the city or wherever, do you use email communication? Is that one your way of sending mass to get a hold of everybody? You send out email to everybody that has a computer at their desk, so that instead of walking around passing out notes, is that what you're using now as your, basically as your bulletin board of the 21st century?
Mr. Rainer, Mr. Chair, Representative, we probably do both.
Okay.
Nelson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And so what would prevent one of your argument that someone could take a communication attach a joke to it what would prevent that same employee from taking one of your communications, attaching a joke, and saying, here, this year's supposed to put this out to all your employees in your group, attaching that joke and having it go around the same way? What, I mean, I think it would create the same problems you were talking about, and I think you've got, should have remedies for that right now in your policies about emails.
Mr. Brainerd. Mr. Chair, Representative, you're correct. We do have policies in place for that. If it's done by an employee today, takes a management piece and sends it out, puts it on the bulletin board, attaches something that's derogatory, something that's political, that kind of thing, yes, we can take some action. This proposed bill, as we read it, takes that possibility away from us if it's communications from the union.
Representative Nelson.
I guess I don't read it that way, but that's, I guess what I'm looking at this is, as we move into the 21st century now, and email is becoming the bulletin board, the way that we communicate with all of our employees, especially when they're in very diverse or far away places, that so they all get the communication at once. This is just allowing, as in the past, those type of notices that would have been on the bulletin board for everyone to see, now this, they're sending them in the same place where everyone can see them. And I guess that's more of a statement than a question.
Representative Lane.
Just a quick clarification. Do you really think that issues of pornography and harassment would be lost in this communication act between labor organizations and employees?
Mr. Brainerd.
Mr. Chair, Representative, yes. I would also add, Mr. Brainerd, I might just indicate, too, that any political documentation, ads, anything, not just the joke that would be added to this, could occur, and we would not be able to respond.
Representative Lane.
Perhaps the attorney could speak to that.
Ms. Joppa.
I'm not sure what the question is.
Whether issues of pornography and harassment would be lost in this act between communication between labor organizations and employees.
And perhaps, if I name Representative Lane, the question of the political nature or communications of a political nature.
All right. I'll talk about pornography or other offensive types of language. As I said a bit ago, I don't see this legislation as condoning that or providing an employee a defense to having sent something that was offensive or obscene. That's not what this legislation is about, and I don't see an open door for that here. And so I'm not seeing the concern. I understand the concern, but I don't see this legislation as providing an employee who sent that kind of information out, or a union official, if it was, which we do training on that type of thing and try very hard not to get ourselves sued as well. So I don't think that we're opening the door for that kind of thing and providing somebody a immunization thing from having sent something offensive through the mail. Political mail sent out by a union could be the kind that is covered under the communication as defined in D, which is on line 1.15. It says any printed electronic document, letter, brochure, flyer, advertisement, email, text message, or similar. So,
anything else, Representative Lane? Thank you. Representative Gunther.
Well, it's been so long ago, I don't remember what I was going to say. I think I did just get a question, though, Ms. Joppa. Isn't it against the National Labor Relations Act to send political literature and statements through the public, the employer's communication system during employer's time?
Ms. Joppa.
I don't know if I can answer that question. To be honest with you, I deal with public employees in the state of Minnesota for the most part. People who work for cities, counties, school districts, public nursing homes, or public hospitals. We do have a few private employers that we represent. I'm not as well versed in the National Labor Relations Act and political mail as I might be. I think there's maybe some more restrictions under federal election law or state election law about those kinds of things, but I haven't had the time to go and research that, so I'm sorry I can't adequately answer your question.
Ms. Joppa, two questions then. Are there, if I can getting more like Representative Gunther every day. Are there...
Maybe that's a good thing.
It's not a bad thing. Are there limits in PELRA or other law applicable to public employees in terms of content of communication from their union? Do we govern the content of union communications to public employees in the state?
In other ways?
In other ways.
The Minnesota Government Data Practices Act most definitely would govern the communication between employees concerning any data that whole statute covers, and there's a lot to that particular statute, lots of different kinds of data and communication. There are other laws like HIPAA that govern people who work in nursing home settings or in healthcare or maybe even social work when they have to communicate about healthcare information. There are lots of different kinds of laws that govern the communication of people in the workplace on particular kinds of topics.
Let me clarify my question because I think I stumbled too much. Do we govern the content of communication between the exclusive representative and their members in state law? I understand your point of employee communication regarding data in the course of their work. I'm talking between the exclusive rep and their members.
In a searching for the right word, in a way that Bureau Mediation Services regulates to a certain extent the manner in which employers and employees who are in public employee unions interact in the state of Minnesota, but does somebody regulate the communications and the like? I guess I'd for the most part say no.
Thank you. Anything else, Representative Gunther? Thank you. Representative Dietrich.
Yes, thank you, Mr. Chair. Representative Anzels, I am with Representative House. I'm 99% there also. And there's one issue that I have with, and that is on page 1, line 1.24, where we talk about reasonable rules, and then on line 1.25 that are permitted. I think a lot of the discussion today has could be resolved by defining the reasonable rules, and that should be done by the management. And so I think what we want to be is a little bit more prescriptive in saying that we need reasonable rules, and they need to, and reasonable rules are only good as long as they are articulated or disseminated, and so that everybody truly is on the same page. So I have asked House Research to deal with that a little bit, and I think I would like to offer it as a friendly oral amendment if you would accept it.
Ms. Newman.
Mr. Chair and Representative, the amendment would be on line 24. After computer and before the period, you would insert, if conducted in accordance with written policy, with reasonable written policies and rules established by the employer and posted throughout the workplace concerning review of these types of communications during break times or non-working times. And then you would delete the remainder of line 24 and all of line 25.
We'll give everybody a half a minute to take that in and then ask Ms. Newman to repeat it. If you would, please.
On line 24, you strike everything after the period and strike all of line 25. And then you insert after computer, if conducted in accordance with reasonable written policies and rules established by the employer and posted throughout the workplace concerning review of these types of communications during break times or non-working times.
How are we doing down there, Representative Anzels?
Mr. Chair, I find that brilliant and
thank you. a standard rarely achieved in legislation.
And very friendly to the process here.
Representative Anzels.
Mr. Chair, could you read it a third time?
Mr. Chair and Representative Anto. Line 24, I'm going to start with the deletions first. Delete everything after the period and delete all of line 25. Then after computer, insert, if conducted in accordance with reasonable written policies and rules established by the employer and posted throughout the workplace concerning review of these types of communications during break times or non-working time, period.
There is Van Zels.
Mr. Chair, we have one additional thought. In the line established by the employer, we would suggest working the words by the employer and the collective bargaining agent.
Is that Representative Dietrich, is that an agreeable amendment to your amendment to
yes.
you? Thank you. Representative Vanzos, do you wish to simply incorporate the Dietrich amendment into the bill?
Mr. Chairman, yes, that would be fine.
Thank you. Representative Scales, Representative Dietrich, was there more? I'm sorry.
Thank you.
Is this to this, well,
yes, Mr. Chairman, I don't...
Representative Scales, if you'll, please.
Two reasons. Representative Anzalk isn't a member of this committee. He can't incorporate anything. Number two, I don't think we can incorporate something into a bill. We can incorporate something into an amendment, and I might be wrong. I'm just making sure we pass this out of here correctly.
I do not have a degree in parliamentary procedure, so I appreciate
I think
senior members' counsel.
Dietrich could incorporate that change in her amendment, and then we could vote on her amendment.
Then. Thank you. Putting it in reverse briefly.
Okay, I would incorporate that change into my amendment.
All right. Any further discussion to the Dietrich amendment?
Mr. Chair.
Representative Nelson.
Mr. Chair, I guess, and Representative Dietrich, I like it, but I'm just thinking, because it says the collective bargaining unit, what about employee groups that don't have a collective bargaining unit? Would an employer still be able to put rules in, written policy, that these communications are forbidden with unions or whatever? I mean, that would be, if they're not covered by that, by adding that term collective bargaining unit. And I guess that's just a concern. I guess I'm asking a question or a miss of the thought out there.
Ms. Newman, can you speak to that? Sorry to catch you unaware.
I guess the concern I have is that by adding the word collective bargaining unit, and I understand where we're going with that, and I like that part of it, but could this then, the idea of being able to put written rules in place, anyone that doesn't have a collective bargaining unit, could the employer establish rules that would prohibit any of these types of communications just by putting it in written rule? And now you wouldn't be able to do what the bill's trying to stop.
Ms. Newman.
Mr. Chair, Representative Nelson, the question is if it's not a group of employees covered by a collective bargaining agreement, can the employer just
put written rules and post them and distribute them and prohibit the activity that we're trying to permit here?
Mr. Chair, and Representative Nelson, I think that would turn on this question of reasonable rules again.
Okay.
And how that would be construed.
Just a concern and a thought.
Thank you. Ms. Jaffa, did you want to respond to the Representative Nelson's question?
Quite oftentimes, I deal with workplaces, too, where somebody calls and asks me the question, even though they're not a part of my union or what have you, can my employer do this or that? And I think that in those situations, the general rule of thumb is where there isn't a collective bargaining agent or an exclusive rep, maybe there's an informal association or something, the fallback position is that now the employer can go ahead and do this on their own. And so the amendment as written, I think I would take it to be that where there is a collective bargaining agent, the employer needs to deal with that group of employees to write these rules. If there's not, then the employer's going to be able to write the reasonable rules and post them and have people abide by them.
Thank you, Ms. Jaffa. Representative Anderson to this point? Okay. Representative Dietrich. All right.
Any further discussion to the Dietrich Amendment? Ms. Newman, would you be willing to reread the amendment as amended one last time, and then we'll take a question from Representative Howes.
Yes, Mr. Chair. The amendment would be on line 24, after computer and before the period, insert, if conducted in accordance with reasonable written policies and rules established by the employer and the collective bargaining agent and posted throughout the workplace concerning review of these types of communications during break times or non-work period. And then the rest of line 24 would be stricken and all of line 25 would be stricken.
Representative House.
Mr. Chairman, I have an excellent memory, but it's short-lived. And did we move the bill?
Yes, we did.
Thank you.
I moved it.
Thank you.
Thank you. With that, all those in favor of the Dietrich Amendment, please signify by saying aye.
Aye. Aye.
Opposed? Motion prevails. Representative Scalzi, thank you for your patience.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And maybe we can get the answer to this from, and this is just a simple question maybe Ms. Joppa could answer. Since we have so many employees in the state of Minnesota that are public employees, nursing home employees, schools, colleges, the largest employer in the state, I believe. So we would have a number of employees that are not covered by the National Labor Relations Act. And do you have any idea how many employees that is? And am I correct in stating, or maybe somebody else here could answer that, and am I correct in stating that that would be the largest employer group in the state, or the largest group of employees in the state?
Ms. Joppa.
I think the simple version is, how many public employees are there in the state of Minnesota amongst all the different governmental entities? And I really don't know. In Council 65, we have over 10,000 union members statewide, and they work for cities, counties, and municipalities for the most part. The Council 5 represents, for AFSCME, represents a fairly large majority of state employees, but you also have MAPE and some other unions that also represent other public employees. Law enforcement has its own union, so what the total number is, I'm not able to answer. But an awful lot of people are covered as public employees in the state of Minnesota.
All right. Members, we have one small amendment correction to the bill that I will move. Page 2, line 1. And Ms. Newman, catch me on this if I get it wrong. Delete the word subdivision and insert the word section. Page 2, line 1, delete the word subdivision, insert the line section. Is that correct, Ms. Newman? Thank you. Seeing no discussion, all those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed? Motion prevails. Thank you, members. Any further discussion on the House File 611? Representative Anderson,
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Representative Anzo and Ms. Joppa, earlier you mentioned about the political, being able to send political messages via email or whatever means of communication. Does that mean that a House or a Senate employee would be able to use their equipment here on the state level to send out political messages?
Ms. Joppa.
I hadn't thought about that scenario, about that. I think the original intent about the legislation concerned union notices and meetings and grievances and ordinary run-of-the-mill things. And so I guess I'm not really sure. I think there, but I don't know the election law or Hatch Act. I think there's a Minnesota Hatch Act that may apply. And so I guess I defer on that one or ask for time to research that.
Representative Anderson.
Well, I believe the Hatch Act only applies to federal employees, not the state.
Mr. Chairman, there is a state Hatch Act in Minnesota, I do believe.
Okay.
So it's been some time since I looked at that.
Representative
Anderson. I don't know the particulars.
Does Ms. Newman?
Mr. Chair, Ms. Newman. Representative Anderson, I'm not familiar with state election law, but I do know that the Senate and the House have policies regarding computer use and the political activities that can be conducted by that. And I think the amendment that Representative Dietrich just added would reference that and cover that.
Okay, but as it stands, now, in the bill in the current form, basically our house rule would be null and void until it was negotiated. Is that correct?
Ms. Newman?
Mr. Chair, I
understand
a misunderstanding. I think so, but because the House and the Senate have rules concerning how computers and other communications can be used, particularly to politics. So.
Representative Anderson, may I?
Yeah.
Was your question whether this legislation would allow you or I to send out political messages using our state computers?
Well, that's part of it. And I guess the other question that I have is, you know, if you've got the employees or us, you know, and the collective, and if there's not a collective bargaining unit present, but there's groups that are interested in that, and, you know, is it a case where they can negotiate that out and say that that's what they don't view it as being a reasonable rule? Could it eventually, I imagine there is the potential for it.
My question may be, Ms. Newman, my understanding of this bill is it deals with communication between a collective bargaining agent and their members, or a collective bargaining agent and working people. And since the House of Representatives is not a collective bargaining agent, that this bill would then not deal with that. Am I understanding this legislation correctly?
Mr. Chair, I believe you're correct. On line 23, it's specific to communications from an employee organization. It's not specific to a collective bargaining group, but it is an employee organization.
Mr. Chair, okay, well, let me take a different route then. Say I'm a teacher in the Buffalo High School, and my teacher's union, for instance, and my teacher's union decided that they wanted to send out a political message. Would they be allowed to do that? I'm guessing yes, they would be able to, right?
Is that a question to me, Ms. Newman, Representative Bells, Ms. Papa, or the collection here with us? Ms. Newman, do you want to take a swing at that?
Mr. Chair, that is well beyond my realm of knowledge with election law and political communication, but perhaps someone from one of the education organizations could answer that.
Ms. Jaffa, I think this gets back to the question that I asked earlier about rules, statute that governs the content of communication between an exclusive bargaining rep and members or others. Can you respond to Ms. Anderson's question for us, please?
I'll try. If we look at the language in Subdivision 2, it says that the employer's not going to discipline or discharge an employee or an applicant because they've received or responded to a communication from an employee organization or labor organization. And they're not going to prohibit, the employer is not going to prohibit the employee from receiving a communication at their work location, etc. Now, then we have to say, well, what's an employee organization? And that's defined in Subdivision 1C. And there we have an employee organization or labor organization having the same meaning as given in Chapter 179 and Chapter 179A. And communication is in D, and there's the definition there, too. It means any printed, electronic document, letter, brochure, flyer, advertisement, email, etc. Now, it doesn't say political or non-political or prohibit one or the other, and so I understand that questions come up, that there might be some concerns about that, but at times unions do try to persuade their members one way or the other about a political topic or a candidate, and so I think the answer is yes. That communication could go to the employee in their work mailbox or what have you.
Ms. Joppa, recently, in the last election cycle, maybe even going back two more, we've seen increased activities by employers, either individual or groupings of employers, setting up websites with information on political candidates and then directing employees to those websites via email. would this govern that use of electronic communications in a political means? Ms. Dapa?
This in no way governs what an employer can or cannot do with regards to communicating with its employees. The employer still has all the freedoms that they have always had in the past to post something on a bulletin board or distribute something to the employees at their desks or put it in their mailboxes and the like. So this doesn't restrict the employer with regards to whatever political persuasion they might want to attempt upon their employees as well.
Thank you. Representative, anything else, Representative Anderson? Representative Gunther.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. It's my understanding, and I think if teachers, and you mentioned teachers, Representative Anderson, if teachers send or a support or, yes, a pro-public communication during work at a work machine, if this occurs, it could cause the school to lose public funding. Now, we have somebody that is an expert in school. Mm-hmm. School's here that can testify to that fact. But that's my understanding, that they could lose public funding if they do send pro-public or political communications over a school computer.
Ms. Joppa.
In this situation, it wouldn't be the school sending that communication. It would be the labor organization sending the communication. If they did that, I would think that they would want to avoid the school district having that difficulty.
Teacher,
President Gunther.
Employee in the school.
Ms. Joppa.
I'm not familiar with that particular legal issue, if it exists.
Representative Fritz, to this point?
And Ms. Representative Anderson, in my district, if it's agreed upon in the collective bargain, in the contract, then the union can put in their boxes literature. It had to be agreed upon, and I think there's some litigation going on now in the state, and we do have someone here from Education Minnesota that could speak to that point if you needed any further clarification. But I think that we've gotten so far away from what this great bill could do for people like myself working out in the nursing homes in greater Minnesota to hear what is going on, and when there is a union meeting that I can go to have my rights and my workplace bettered. I appreciate you bringing this bill forward, and if you needed Education Minnesota, they are here, but I'd like to get on with the vote.
Representative Gunther, I seem to find an amendment at my desk.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Basically, Representative Dietrich and I think very much alike, because you can take the section from 1.5 to 1.10 and delete that from my amendment, because it's basically covered with her amendment. And then we have this amendment that page 1, line 16, basically says, pertaining to union business or labor organization as provided under state and federal law, that is prohibited. And that proposed change clarifies that appropriate union business can be conducted as long as the communications follows the employer's personal policies under union contract. And that's, I think, been also referenced by Ms. Joppa. And then in on page 2, line 1 in my amendment, it's been already taken care of. Page 2, line 2 through 4, after the procedure, insert the period and delete the remainder of that sentence. I think that's also been covered. These changes limit the remedy of an employer's violations of this law to the use of the grievance procedure. Employees and unions already have an ability to use the grievance process to file an unfair labor practice action and to use the negotiation process to negate specific protections for union communications. Also on page 2, line 5 through 7, after the violations, insert a period and delete the remaining language in this subdivision. There are already sufficient legal procedures for determining the establishing awards of damages and grievances in civil judgments between the employers and employee. And that basically covers my amendment, and I certainly will try to answer questions.
Thank you. Representative Anzals, do you wish to respond to the Gunther Amendment? Ms. Jaffa?
Representative Anzal asked me to respond for him.
Thank you.
Well, I think it unduly complicates what we were trying to accomplish. I patterned the language that I originally wrote for this bill after the genetic testing law. I kind of took what was nice and simple and clean and straightforward about that and used that and patterned it, and that's a large part where the remedy section came from. It is in a lot like that. I mean, I know they're totally different subjects, but there was something about how that statute addressed one particular topic, solved one particular problem, and set out the definitions very nicely and set out the remedy very nicely, I thought. And so, your changes to line 24 and 25, we took care of some of that just a moment ago with the amendment that passed, and we felt that that was a friendly amendment. I think that we don't have the same feeling about your amendment, Representative Gunther. I'm sorry.
Unfortunately. Representative Anzals.
Mr. Chairman and Representative Gunther, it just seems to me that the remedy section is necessary in order to create an awareness of what it is we're trying to do here. We need to have the enforcement mechanism in place so that employers and employees throughout employment situations understand that this is important to workers in Minnesota. And without the remedy section, it really deems this to be kind of a paper tiger.
Anyone wishing to testify from the audience, either for or against the Gunther Amendment? Sir, please come to the desk. Mr. Johnson, good to see you. Welcome. Please introduce yourself to the tape.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. My name is Craig Johnson. I'm in government relations with the League of Minnesota Cities, and the amendment that Representative Gunther offered was meant to address a number of concerns we have talked to the author, the chair, and other members of the committee about over the past couple of days. To clarify, I believe when Representative Gunther referred to on his amendment lines 1.5 through 1.10, I believe he was saying that we feel the amendment that Representative Diedrich put onto the bill addresses that adequately, that we can work on that another time, that part wouldn't be needed of this amendment. So he was trying to lay out the rest of the amendment. I can quickly give you my comments on this, Mr. Chair. The first section, line 1.2, simply adds to the end of the definition of communication the clause pertaining to union business or labor organizing as provided under state or federal law. What that is meant to do is to make it clear it helps with the reasonable rules issue, to say if the communication has anything to do with union business or with labor organizing, it qualifies as communication that this is meant to protect. It was not meant to weaken the bill. It was meant to clarify the bill, Mr. Chair, and we're certainly willing to take feedback on that, but I think it's an improvement to the clarity of the bill. The line 1.4 is actually just a technical fix. The way the bill currently reads, it refers to two definitions of labor organization and employee organization. One of those is not an accurate citation. The one that's listed as 1.79A.01, subdivision 6, that does not exist. The definition of employee organization is actually found at 1.79A.03, subdivision 6. So that's just technical. The last two areas deal entirely with the enforcement or remedy sections of the statute. And our comments on that are simply that there actually is a very good process already in place for determining whether a grievance is founded and whether there is some remedy that needs to be made any time an employee is challenging their termination or their disciplinary actions. It's an established process for public employees, and we are not looking for language and would not be supportive of language that adds a bunch of new options, including civil suits and mandatory awards by courts, adding on to that. We think that there are it's a very clear message. If you violate an employee's rights now, the grievance procedure will find you liable for damages for that. And the message is already very clear. We don't need to add additional punitive damages to make that message more clear. Mr. Chair, I'd be happy to try and answer any other questions about the amendment.
Thank you, Mr. Johnson. Any questions for the testifier? Seeing none. Representative Gunther has moved the AO70069 amendment. All those in favor say aye.
Aye.
All those opposed?
No.
No. Motion does not prevail. Any further testimony to the bill? Representative Nelson.
Mr. Chair, I think from what Mr. Johnson said, I think we'd like to do an oral amendment on section, on line 118, to amend that 179.01 to the, or is it the 179.8.01 to the 179.8.03, make it refer to the right section in law.
Ms. Newman, that would be to both references to 179A.01 on line 18?
Mr. Chair, the references to 179A.01 would be stricken and 179A.03 would be inserted.
Nice reading comprehension skills again. Any discussion to the Nelson Amendment? Representative Anzels, is this an acceptable amendment to you, sir?
Mr. Chair, Representative Nelson, thank you.
Seeing that, all those in favor of the Nelson Amendment signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Opposed, same sign. Motion prevails. Any further testimony to the bill? Representative Anzels, any last comments?
I think we've had quite enough, Mr. Chairman. Thank you for your consideration. Appreciate your vote.
The Minnesota House of Representatives is a deliberative body, and we've certainly shown that here today. With that, ladies and gentlemen, all those in favor of the chair renews his motion that the HF 611 amendment, legislation as amended, be recommended to pass and referred to the Committee on Commerce and Labor. All those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Opposed?
No.
Motion prevails. Thank you, Representative Anza.
Thank you very much and have a good weekend.
Ladies and gentlemen, Representative House.
You may be already starting to explain. I was wondering about next Friday since we've delayed one bill that may take a while and you're... Brilliant staff sent me an email saying that I would have a bill up next Friday. Is all this going to change somewhat? Or
I believe it was now Governor Pawlenty who began describing the legislative process as fluid. and we are fluid viscous, Representative Howes. Members, I want to thank both Representative Hansen and Representative Nelson and apologize to the members of the public who came to testify for their bills. They have allowed us to adjourn without hearing those bills today. We will reschedule both of those. We do have additional meeting time scheduled for later in the session, and we will be utilizing that as necessary. With that, members, we stand adjourned. Thank you.